So this week's parasha is Parashas Vayikra. And let's start on page 548. Torah is going through, this is the beginning of the Torah's discussion of Karbanos. And we'll start at the point where the Torah is talking about karbanos that are brought from birds. So the pasuk says, "V'im min ha'oif ayla karbanoi la'Hashem." The Torah is going through the laws of the ola, the burnt offering, the animal that's completely burnt. Nothing is consumed by the kohanim or by the owners. And we know you could bring it from cattle, from sheep. And now we're talking about if it comes from a bird. So, v'min ha'if ayla karbanoi la'Hashem, if his burnt offering, his ola, will be from birds, v'kriv ben ha'tayrim min b'nei ha'yoyna es karbanoi, he shall offer it from tayrim and b'nei yoyna, his karbanoi, his sacrifice. The two birds mentioned are tayrim b'nei yoyna. So the art scroll translates tayrim as turtle doves, right? That's tayrim, or turtle doves. You know, whatever that is exactly. And b'nei yoyna are young doves. So even though they both carry the name doves, they're seemingly two different birds. And the halacha is that when it comes to these birds, the halacha is that when it comes to the tayrim, the turtle doves, they are adult turtle doves and not minors, whatever that means exactly, whichever way that's determined. Actually, the Rashi talks about how it's determined. And b'nei yoyna are ketanim v'lo gedolim. They are the child ones, not the adult ones. So the turtle doves are adult. The b'nei yoyna are the minors, the children, the non-adults. Okay? And basically, Rashi says that there's some kind of a yellowing that develops. And that yellowing is considered an adult, when it is a sign of adulthood for the b'nei yoyna, for the young, for the doves, and it's a sign of being a minor, of being a child bird when it comes to the turtle doves. Okay, so the turtle doves have to be adults, while the doves have to be the young doves. So Rabbi Nebuchaya gives a very interesting explanation as to why the Torah chose these birds, and why is one bird the adult, and one bird the non-adult. And the Brain of Achai explains that the reason why the turtle dove, are the adults is because the turtle dove represents what the Brain of Achai calls dveikus, connection, or what we'll call loyalty, fidelity. A female turtle dove gets its mate, and once it loses its mate, it will never go to another bird. That's the kind of loyalty, that's the kind of fidelity that it has to its mate. And therefore, the Torah wants the turtle dove, the adult turtle dove, because of that trait that it displays. The Jewish people are like that in the sense that they cling to Hashem, they connect to Hashem, their fidelity is to Hashem, and they do not change him for any other god. So the turtle dove is meant to represent a message of fidelity, of loyalty to Hashem, just as the turtle dove, the adult female turtle dove, has this absolute loyalty to her mate, and even if the mate is lost, she doesn't go to another one. That's regarding the turtle dove. So therefore, the child turtle doves aren't good for the carbon because they're not ready yet to mate. They're not ready yet to take a mate. Now, when it comes to the doves, for that, the Torah invalidated the adult ones. When it comes to the adult doves, they are extremely jealous over their mate. They're extremely protective over their mate. And it seems that they are constantly, because of this overprotection, they are constantly getting into, you know, chasing away any bird who gets near, and therefore they actually create peer, they create separation. So they don't represent, so the adult birds represent this kind of jealousy that breaks apart. And that, of course, is a trait that we don't want to have. And therefore, it's the younger turtle doves who are not yet ready to mate, to have a mate. They don't display this kind of trait yet, and therefore they are the ones that are valid. So the reason why we want the adult by the turtle doves is because the adult turtle doves display a trait of loyalty, of fidelity, and the child ones don't are too young to mate, so therefore they don't have that trait. When it comes to the doves is that we don't want the adult ones because of the fact that they display a trait of jealousy and of period of separation, of dispute, and therefore the Rebbeinu Shimon shows the younger ones that don't display that trait. So it's interesting that the Rebbeinu Yehuda does. I'm sorry, the Rebbeinu Bechaya doesn't talk about each species on its own. What's the point of that species? But it does explain why one of them it's the adults and by one it's the minors. Then he ends off and he says, "Amashach shira atara tarnagolim." Why didn't the Torah allow tarnagolim, chickens, roosters, hens? How come the Torah didn't allow that? Lefish and bali zima means that they are promiscuous. They are not. They do not show loyalty or fidelity. They're bali zima. They're all over the place. So therefore, the tarnagolim, the rooster, the hen, that we don't want because they're bali zima. They don't show fidelity. They don't show loyalty. While these other birds actually do. You know, I'm wondering, he doesn't say this to Rebbeinu Bechaya, but you can understand if the turtle dove does show that kind of loyalty, we know why the turtle dove. When it comes to the regular dove, we just said, why not the adult? But perhaps, again, the dove also, we don't want to go as far as the adult dove because of the fact that it has this trait of jealousy and bringing strife. But it does display, again, a certain level of fidelity, of loyalty. And therefore, so we don't want it at the point where it shows that kind of fidelity to a fault, but we do choose the Yonah, the dove, because of the fact that it does represent a certain level of fidelity. Perhaps that's what is included in his words. I'm not sure, but it's an interesting explanation. Rebbeinu Bechaya, how can we choose the adult turtle dove because of the fidelity that it represents and it shows, and we don't use the adult dove because its kind of fidelity or its overprotection of its mate is actually where that is displays jealousy and creates period and creates separation. Okay. Now, let's skip down a few psukim. And the Torah says, and this is again in regarding to the birds, and this is Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17, where the Torah says, V'shisa oisai b'chnafav. When it comes to a bird, you split it, and you split it, b'chnafav. Of course, after you have slaughtered it, you're supposed to split it. And you're supposed to split it bichnafav with its feathers. That is how the bird is supposed to be offered. It's supposed to be, it has its way of slaughtering, which is not from the front, but through its neck. After it's slaughtered, then certain parts are taken out, and then it's split, and the feathers remain. And that's how it's offered, with the feathers. So Rashi comments about the offering with the feathers, that, and Rashi is actually quoting a Medrash. The Medrash says, right, this is Pasuk Zayin in Rashi. Rashi says, Bichnafav, Noitza Mamish, you leave on its feathers. So Rashi quotes a Medrash that says, V'aloi ein l'cha hedyot shemeriach reachra shal knafim nisrafim, v'nafshe katza alav. Burnt feathers is a very unpleasant thing to smell. Rashi says, "Ein lo chayedit." There's no simple person, even the coarsest of people, cannot get disgusted over the smell that comes from burnt feathers. If so, why is the Torah saying that we're supposed to offer it, burn it with its feathers? The answer is, "Kadei shayam isbeach savea umahuder bekarbanu shaloni," so that the altar should be sated and adorned with the sacrifice of the poor man. The Mefarshim in the Medrash explain, the Eitz Yosef explains that what that means is, what Rashi means to say is, what the Medrash is saying is that if you were to pluck its feathers, there'd be very little left of this bird. And therefore, by keeping the feathers on, it appears big. It appears more significant. And the purpose of going out of our way to want it to appear significant is how Hashem shows the poor person who's typically bringing a bird, the person who can't afford a larger animal. And therefore, to show that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is 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 it very much is machshava. Hashem gives importance to the sacrifice of the poor man. The Rebbe Hashem wants it to be, he wants his sacrifice to adorn, to be bigger and to appear bigger, therefore more significant, and thus adorn the altar. So the point is that the sacrifice that appears bigger is a greater honor, is a more significant sacrifice, a greater honor to the altar. And although it's going to have a bad smell, which would be a reason to remove the feathers, we keep the feathers on. We want it to look bigger. We want it to have that bigger appearance because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to show the poor man that he considers his sacrifice significant and important. Now let's now read. Actually, before I go further in the Medrash, I'd like to read. Just 1 second. Right. Let's read now. Perek Beis, Pasuk Aleph, which is the very next Pasuk. The nefesh ki sakriv karba mincha la Hashem, and a soul that will offer a meal offering to Hashem, soilis yer karbanoi, his sacrifice will be a fine flour. V'yatzak oleh ha-shemen, he shall pour out an oil, v'nasad oleh ha-levayne, and put on the frankincense. So here we're talking about a karban mincha. A karban mincha is flour and oil. And here, when the Torah talks about a person who is bringing this carbon, the Torah describes that person as v'nefesh, as a soul. So Rashi comments, and again, this is actually a Gemara, v'nefesh ki sakri. Rashi says, lo yinemai nefesh b'chol karbanas nedava ela b'mincha. No one is referred to as a nefesh by all the other voluntary sacrifices except when it comes to the mincha, when it comes to the meal offering. And the reason is, mi darkai lisnadev mincha ani, mincha. Who is the one that typically offers a meal offering? Again, as a volunteer sacrifice. Ani, a poor man. He's really poor. He can't even afford a bird. He's offering a meal offering. That's how poor he is. Omar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, malani alav kilu hikriv nafshei. I consider it as if he has offered his own soul. The reason why the Torah is using the word soul by a mincha is to bring out the idea that a person who is so poor that all he can afford is a meal offering, all he can bring is a meal offering, but he offers that meal offering, and clearly that meal offering is something that is not even probably very easy for him to do. There's a lot of sacrifice even in that, in giving up from the, in even bringing a meal offering. The Torah says, as small as it may be, as insignificant it may be, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I look at it as if you have offered your soul, as if he has offered his soul. The fact that he's even going so far to do this, he is so poor, and he's still giving up that little bit of flour that he has, he's giving up from himself, because of the fact that he really has nothing, and he's still bringing a sacrifice to Hashem, he's giving up from himself. For that Hashem says, I look at it as if he is offering his own, he's offering his soul. So we have here two examples, two sayings from Chazal, from our sages, that talk about how Hashem shows respect and gives consideration even to the sacrifice of the poor. The sacrifice of the poor is a much smaller sacrifice than it comes to other sacrifices, but the Rebbeinu Shalom recognizes the sacrifice of the poor in doing what they do, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to make sure that it's clear that the sacrifice of the poor are considered important. That's why the burnt offering bird is going to leave on its feathers so it should look large. And although there's not much you can do about the meal offering to make it look any bigger than it is, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu still lets the poor man know, I recognize what you're doing, I recognize your self-sacrifice, and I recognize how you're giving, how much you're giving up literally from yourself, and I consider it as if you have offered yourself as a sacrifice. Now, the Medrash, in this week's Parsha, brings down the first Rashi, this first Rashi about the fact that on the bird offering, we leave the feathers on, it smells, but still, we want to leave on the feathers so that the Mizbeach, so that the altar should be adorned with the sacrifice of the Ani. There should be, the Ani's sacrifice should be a big one, a large one, which is always seen as a more significant sacrifice, and a greater honor to the Mizbeach. Okay. Now, the Medrash continues with a couple of small anecdotes. And these anecdotes, the way I understand it, are all coming to actually, again, show and bring out this idea of how Hashem, how he recognizes, how Hashem, how the Torah recognizes the sacrifice involved in a needy person bringing a sacrifice or giving up from himself for the sake of a sacrifice. So the Medrash says like this, Agrifas HaMelech, there was a king Agrifas, Bikei Shalakar B'yem Echad Elef Eilis, wanted to bring 1,000 burnt offerings in one day. Impressive. Shalach Ramal Kayin Gadol, therefore he sent a message to the Kayin Gadol, Al Yakriv Adam Hayyim, Chutz Mimeni. You can't take any sacrifice from anybody today, except for me. I'm doing 1,000 today. Whatever reason he wants to do that, no one else can bring karbanos today. Bani Echad, came a poor man to the Beis HaMikdash, Shabiyadai Shtei Seirim. In his hands he had two terim, he had two turtle doves. Amar Lakayin, Hakriv Es Elu, please offer these. Amalei HaMelech Tzivani, Vamalei Al Yakriv Adam Chutz Mimeni Hayayim. The king sent me a message, the only one bringing sacrifices today is me. Amalei, the poor man said, Adoini Kayin Gadol, my master Kayin Gadol, Arba'a Ani Tzad B'chol Yayim. I hunt, I catch 4 birds every day. Vani Makriv Shnayim, I offer to, Umispayne Shnayim, and I sustain myself unto. If you're not going to offer the two that I always offer, you're going to cut off my parnas, you're going to cut off my livelihood. Now, I'm not 100% sure what the explanation of that means, why, if he doesn't bring those two, offer those two, the other two he can't eat. I'm assuming the explanation is that this was his kind of, this was his practice, right? He doesn't eat the other two. He doesn't sustain himself on the other two unless he gives two to Hashem. And therefore he's saying to the Kayan, if you're not going to offer these two, then I'm not gonna have what to sustain myself on today. Not on the Krivan. So the Kayan got to listen, took it, and offered them. Then the Medrash says, Nira Loy Lagrifas Bachaloim. And then appeared to Karifas in a dream. Karban shal ani kademcha, a poor man's karban preceded yours. Now, I don't know the nature of this dream. I didn't see Yenim Mefarshim explain the nature of this dream. But somehow or another, it seems that Min HaShemayim from heaven, they sent him a message letting him know that, although today you were supposed to be the only one bringing, your plan was to be the only one bringing karbanos today, a poor man's karban preceded you. Sholach melekayin gadol, akatsa v'sicha, al yakriv adam chutz meni hayayim. He sent a message to Kayin Gadol. Didn't I tell you nobody but me today? Ormalei Adoni HaMelech. So he told me the whole story. My master the king. Ba'ari Yachar B'yadei Shnei Tayrim. A poor man came before me with two doves, two turtle doves. Ormalei Hakriv Es Elu. He asked me to offer them. Amarti Lo HaMelech Tzivani. Ormalei Al Yachriv Adam Chutz Meni Hayayim. And I told him, the king told me, no one brings out sacrifices besides for me today. Omar, and then he said to me, Arani Tzad B'chayayim. I catch 4 every day, but in Makriv Mishnayim, Espanis Mishnayim, I offer 2, I sustain myself unto, Imi Ata Makriv Ata Chaytech Parasasi. If you don't offer, I'm not gonna have, you're cutting off my parnasi, you're cutting off my sustenance. So early Lakrivan. So I shouldn't have brought them. Amala Yafa Asisa Kamasha Asisa. You did the right thing. So now in this medrash, what's happening here? In this medrash, what's happening is that, again, this poor man showed his dedication. Every day he brings 2 sacrifices. Every day he brings the 2 sacrifices and he doesn't eat and he doesn't sustain himself on the other 2 unless he brings. A very clear sacrifice in this poor man's part of how he, again, of the 4 that he catches, 2 he offers. The other 2 he won't sustain himself on unless he brings the other 2. A clear sacrifice on this poor man's part, and because of that, he had the right to go ahead. He had the right to bring the sacrifice, and in Shemayim they tell Agrifas, his sacrifice preceded yours. His sacrifice preceded yours. He had the right to go ahead and offer ahead of yours because of his dedication. Interesting anecdote. Next, now the Gemara brings another one. Ma'ase b'shar echad. There was a story about an ox. They were pulling it to bring a kapi as a sacrifice and wouldn't go. Ba'ani came a poor man, Ubiyaday aguda achashal truksima. He had a bunch of a certain plant called truksima. Vahishitlay, he gave it to the shar, to the ox. V'achla, it ate it. Goash hashar. Then the ox goash. I don't know if it means it burped. It regurgitated it. I'm not sure exactly what it means, but gosh, I think it means it burped. V'hoitzi machat, and now popped a machat, a needle. V'nimshak lakarbon, and then it continued to be drawn for the carbon. So there was something very interesting here. Something, you know, this the way the Mefarshim explain is had this needle inside. If it would have been shechted, the needle would have actually punctured something inside and made it a trefa. That's why it wasn't going. Somehow or another, this poor man knew what to do. And he got, and by basically giving up this little bit of vegetables that he had, he now made it that this animal would go to be a carbon. So again, the Medrash says, Nira labal ashar b'chaloymai. Now the owner of this ox had a dream, and it appeared to him in the dream, Karbanis shalani kademcha. The sacrifice of this poor man preceded yours. There was no sacrifice here, the poor man. He didn't bring any animal. But the point is that what did he do in order for the animal to be able to be a karban? He gave up those vegetables that he had. That was his participation of the karban. He couldn't even bring a karban. But he gave up those vegetables in order to get the animal to be a carbon, and therefore the dream was his sacrifice. What he gave, those vegetables that he gave, it preceded your sacrifice. He got his sacrifice preceded yours. HaKadosh Baruch Hu recognizes the sacrifice that he gave up, what he gave up in order for the sacrifice to happen. Okay, that's the second one. So here it's interesting because he's not even bringing a sacrifice. He's not bringing any sacrifice here. But what he gave up to allow another sacrifice to be able to be done, that is what he was, that was his significance. That's what he was recognized for. He was recognized for, again, what he gave up. It seems those vegetables were something he could have eaten himself. He was so poor, he would have eaten them himself. He gave it up for the animal to be able to be a carbon, and therefore what he gave up preceded the actual carbon, preceded in Shemayim, and had a greater merit in Shemayim than the actual sacrifice of this person. Then the Medrash brings a third anecdote, and it takes it a step further. Ma'aseh b'isha achas. There was a story with a woman. She'hevia kaimetz shel seilas. She brought a kaimetz of flour. She brought a fistful of flour. V'yakayin mevaza olea, and the kayin was being very disrespectful about it. V'amar re'umahei makrivas. Look what they're bringing. Mabazelecha, mabazelahakriv. What's there to eat? What's there to offer? I don't know if he did it in front of her face, but clearly he wasn't happy with what he brought because in essence what she brought was too small to be anything. She brought only a fistful of flour. That's not enough. That's not enough to be anything. So basically, we're saying, look what they're bringing. They're bringing nothing. Nira l'kayin b'chaloyim. Now this kayin had a dream. And it appeared to him in a dream, Altavaza Olea. Don't disgrace her. Don't look down at her. Ki'ilu nafshe hikriva. It's as if she offered her soul. That means, you're right, what she brought was so insignificant she couldn't do anything with it. But you know what? You take it anyway. You take it from her. You take it. You're the kayin. You're the representative of Hashem. You're the kayin. You take it from her. You eat it. Because it's as if she offered her soul. She wanted to bring a carbon. What is she bringing it here for? She's bringing it because she wants to do something. And this is all she has. And this is all she has to bring. You can imagine how little she has in general. But she wanted to bring something. She's giving this up, this little bit, which is probably so important, to her own livelihood. She gives it up for the Ribbono Shel Olam. Even if it can't be an actual carbon, a sacrifice, take it from her. And realize that her desire to bring a carbon and to give up so much of herself to bring a carbon is Rabbi Hashem looks at that as if she offered her soul. So she even bring a carbon. She's not bringing a carbon. She's not even involved in bringing a carbon. There's no carbon here, in essence. It's not like the story before where the poor man facilitated a carbon to be brought. That's not happening here. She can't. Her amount is too small, and she can't partner up with someone else. The Mefarta Eitzesev, it says, she can't, let's say, take her a little bit and combine it with somebody else's, because you can't bring a carbon mincha in a partnership. An animal you can bring in a partnership. You can't bring a carbon mincha in a partnership. So therefore, whatever she was going to bring could not actually be offered. But it's ki'ili kronapsha. She wants to bring a carbon. She wants to give something to the Rabbi Nishalaylam. And she's giving up, and this little bit for her is so much. The Rabbi Nishalaylam looks at that, ki'ili kronapsha. The Rabbi Nishalaylam looks at that as if she has offered her soul. And then the Medrash, please join us. And then the Medrash continues. V'rei dvarim kal v'chomer. Now we can make a kal v'chomer. Kal v'chomer meaning we can make an argument to go from one step to another step. Uma imi she'enoi makriv nefesh, ksiv by nefesh. Someone who does not actually offer a soul. The Torah says, uses the word nefesh, meaning we look at it as if they did offer a soul. Mishu makriv nefesh alachas kama v'kama. Someone actually does offer a soul. How much more so? Uki'ilu nafshi hikriv. It's as if he offered his soul. The Eitz Yosef explains that the Medrash is saying like this: the ani, as we read, the poor man, as we read, doesn't even have an animal to bring. You know, the sacrifice is a sacrifice is according to many of the commentaries, a sacrifice is meant that it's a soul in place of a soul. And when you bring a meal offering, you bring a karma mincha, you don't have that. Still, the Torah says, I look at it as if he offered his soul. I look at it as if he offered his soul. He didn't actually offer any kind of soul. He has nothing to compare it to say it's as if he's offered his own soul, because there is no soul in a meal offering. However, because of the sacrifice involved, because of how much he's giving up himself that's involved, Hashem says, it's as if he's offered a soul. It's as if he's offered a soul. So if when you don't actually offer a soul, the Torah considers as if you did, how much more so when you really do offer a soul, which the Matnas Kahuna commentary explained means, when you offer a soul means when you fast and do tshuva. That's what the Medrash is referring to, when you actually offer a soul. When you actually, meaning, the poor man gives up from himself. He doesn't actually offer any kind of soul, but he gives up from himself, and that's considered as if he's offered a soul. Well, if that's considered offering a soul, all the more so when you actually offer your soul in the sense of doing tshuva, of fasting, repenting, that again, that's giving up from yourself, how much more so does the Torah consider that, like you're actually offering a soul when you're really giving up so much from yourself through fasting and through tshuva. But it's really fascinating how the Medrash is going through all these different levels and trying to show all the different possible levels of how the poor man who offers, who when he brings a sacrifice, he doesn't really have anything, but he's still offering and he's giving up so much of himself to be able to bring a carbon to Hashem, how much significance, how important, how great it is in the eyes of Hashem, how important it is when he does these things. And again, the third case was a case where this woman, she didn't even bring anything that could be a carbon. She had no involvement in the carbon. And still, what did it say? It said in the dream that it said to the Kayin, don't look down at that. Even that is Kehilu Hikrav Nasha. Even that is considered as if she's offered her soul. She can't be. It's not actually going to be a carbon. It's not enough to be a carbon. But she wanted so much at least to give something. That's also considered as if she offered her soul. So I want to share with you two interesting stories. One of them is, again, to bring out a very similar point about this third story. And that is that I tried finding the story. I know I've seen it in a sefer and I couldn't find it. So I couldn't see inside all the details of it. But the story goes how there was a simple Jew who one time came to hear the Rav's, the Rosh of the Rav's class. And the class was about the Lechem Apanim. Lechem Apanim, we know that one of the vessels in the Mishkan, in the Tabernacle, the Beis HaMikdash, was the table. And on the table there was the bread, the Lechem Apanim, the special bread that was on the table from Shabbos to Shabbos. It stayed fresh a whole week and it was changed every week. And the Rav was speaking about the Lechem Apanim, how the Lechem Apanim was brought onto the Shulchan every Shabbos in the Beis HaMikdash, and every week it stayed fresh and it changed over. And this simple person was very taken. very taken by this. And therefore, he decided that every week, he's also going to bring lechem upon him. He's going to offer his own lechem upon him. He's going to offer his own bread to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. So what did he do? So one Shabbos, one Arab Shabbos, he decided, you know, his wife baked bread, baked challis, took two challis, walked into shul, when nobody was looking, opened up the aron, opened up the ark, put the two loaves of bread down, and then closed the ark. That was his way of offering lechem upon him to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. Okay? And his plan was, next week he'll come back, right, and see, you know, did Hashem accept his carbon, his sacrifice? Well, when the Shamus came into shul to do his duties, he opened up the aron, and what did he see? Two loaves of bread. No identification. Nobody knows where the loaves of bread came from. So what did he do? He took them. So the next week, this person comes back. The person who put the challis comes back. And what does he do? He opens up the ark, and he sees it's not there. And he's so excited. The Rebbeinu Shalom took his karbonis. Rebbeinu Shalom took his lechem upon him. Right? And from then on, he did this every week. Every week, he took two challis. He put it in the aron. This was his lechem upon him. And every week, the ones from the week before were gone. And this is what he kept doing this for a while. Until one day, he walks into shul and he's, you know, bringing his carbon of sorts. And the Rav walks in. And he sees him opening up the aron, putting the bread in the aron. And he says, what are you doing? So he said, I'm bringing lechem upon him. You know, every week I come in and I put the challis into the aron and I close it and I come back next week and they're gone. So the Rav, you know, decides to check into this, and the Rav discovers that and lets the person know it's not the Rabbeinu Shalom taking his loaves, it's the Shamus taking his loaves. So of course the person was very disappointed and he stopped doing it. So the story ends that the Rav had a dream. And in his dream there was a message from Shemayim that he didn't do right by stopping this person from bringing those loaves. Because I wanted to find the story inside to get the exact wording. But the point was is that there hasn't been something bringing so much pleasure to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam than these two loaves in a long time. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam has not had such pleasure in a long time from anything like these two loaves that he's having pleasure from. And you stopped it, and you're responsible for it. The same idea is here. Same idea. It was all about the sincerity. It was all about the desire to do something. It's all about wanting to give something to Rabbeinu Shel Olam. Some kind of a carbon, some kind of a gift to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. That's the same story here by this woman. She didn't bring enough flour to actually being a carbon. And the Kayan said, so what's she not bringing anything? And in the dream they told him, Al Tavaza, don't look down at her. It's as if she's offered her soul. She wants to bring, she's doing what she can, she's giving up for herself, and it's as if she has offered her soul the same way the Torah says by somebody who actually offers a mincha. Okay. One last thing about this that I want to mention, another interesting story that brings out this whole idea about the sacrifice of the poor man and how to try to appreciate it. So I saw a story brought down about a person who survived the Holocaust. And he talks about how when he was in the camp, that there was another Jewish man there in the camp with him, and his bread ration was stolen from him. The teeny little bread ration that he had was stolen from him. And the person was very upset. He was extremely distraught. Because as little as the bread was, it was what kept them alive. It was what kept them from the brink of starvation. And without that little bit of bread, he was going to die. And he didn't know what to do. So the person relating the story says how he and other people and other friends of his all broke off a bit from their own bread and gave it to him. From the little bit of bread that they have, each one broke off something and gave it to this man that he should be able to survive. And the man said that we know that we saved a life, but more than just the fact that we saved a life, we really gained insight to what it means to give. This was the highest form of giving, where literally they needed it for themselves and they gave it up for someone else. They experienced what it is to truly give. And the man continued the story. He survived the Holocaust, became a very wealthy man. And he gave, and in his recognition to Hashem for saving him from the Holocaust, he gave tremendous amounts of money to yeshivas and organizations and institutions. Hundreds and thousands of dollars. But he said that as much as I have given, all that I gave, I was able to afford to give. And after I gave, I still had left. Nothing compares to that giving that I gave. Nothing compares to that little morsel of bread that I gave when I gave it, when I wasn't able to afford it. When it was really so important to me, it was so necessary for me, and I still gave it up, that was a true experience of giving. And all the hundreds and thousands of dollars that I've given doesn't compare. It doesn't compare to that giving, that experience of giving that I did when I gave that little bit of bread to help that person in the concentration camp. It's a story that elucidates the idea of giving up of yourself when it's not easy to give. When it's not like I can afford to give. When I can't afford to give, but I still give, that's true giving. That is true giving. Okay. Next thing that I want to share with you, okay, is the following. For this, I'm going to go back to the beginning of the parasha. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, page 544. And the Pasuk reads as follows. Vayikra el Moshe. And he, referring to Hashem, called to Moshe. Vayidaber Hashem elav. And Hashem spoke to him. May oil mayed from the tent of meeting, referring to the Mishkan, the tabernacle, lemar, to say. So the Gemara in Yuma says that from this pasuk we learn a halacha. We learn a halacha that says that goes this that says the following: Minayin laomer devar lachaver reshuba bal yomar. How do you know that if someone says something to you that you're not allowed to say it? Reuven tells Shimon something. How do you know that Shimon cannot relate what Reuven said to him unless Reuven tells him that he can? How do you know that? How do you know if someone says something to you, you can only relate it if the person says, you can go say it? The answer is this pasuk. Vayikra el Moshe, Hashem spoke to, called to Moshe. Hashem spoke to him from the oil moyed, lemar, to say. There's something that lies in that word lemar. Rashi, this is Gemara and Yuma. Rashi and Yuma says, you take the word lemar and you turn it into like an acronym. Instead of it being lemar, it's loy omar, don't say. Being don't say until I say you can say it. So Hashem spoke to him, lemar, not to say unless it is lemar to say. The Marsha says that the way the Gemara is learning this from this pasuk is actually because the word lemar is extra. You know, the pasuk could have just said, "Vayidaber Hashem elav ma'el ma'ed." Hashem spoke to him from the tent. "Dabro b'nei Yisrael," speak to b'nei Yisrael. Why does it say lemar? And therefore, the word lemar to say is coming to teach that you know why Moshe was able to relate what Hashem told him, because Hashem told him, because it was lemar. Hashem told him to say it over. Otherwise, he couldn't say it over. So the Chafetz Chaim has an interesting discussion about what this Gemara means. So does that mean if I tell you anything, I tell you something completely benign, you can't say it over? So the Chafetz Chaim says, no, it's not what it means. Because Chafetz Chaim says that actually, the Chafetz Chaim brings down the Rambam. The Rambam, when the Rambam talks about Lashon Hara, the Rambam says that Lashon Hara is saying something that's going to cause either physical damage, monetary damage, emotional damage, whatever it may be. The wording that you're going to say over has to be something that, if you say it over, it could cause the person damage. Okay? If what I told you is completely benign, and now you say it over, what kind of damage is going to happen to me? Well, but, you know, if you look in the Gemara, And if you think about it, the Gemara doesn't seem to say that, you know, you only can't say something over that could cause the person some kind of problem if you say it over. The Gemara just says, somebody tells you something, you can't tell it over unless he gives you permission. And to say that the Gemara means only means that it's talking about where what he divulged to you. If you were to say it over, it would be damaging to him. The Chafetz Chaim makes an argument to say that's a bit problematic in this pasuk, because the person talking here is the Ribbono Shel Olam. And whatever you say to after, and whatever Moshe would have divulged that Hashem said isn't going to cause Ribbono Shel Olam any kind of damage, any kind of distress. And therefore, he makes an argument to say that this halacha in Yuma would apparently be saying that even if it's completely benign, he can't say it over. So he says no. He says no. It's not. That's not what it means. Because he mentions that the Rambam doesn't even mention this halacha. The manager makes no mention of it. If somebody tells you something, don't say it over. When he talks about the laws of Lashon Hara, he doesn't even mention it. All he talks about is saying something that if you were to say about someone, this thing you're saying about someone, if it causes them some kind of damage or distress, that's Lashon Hara. But if it's completely benign, what should be the problem? Therefore, the Chafetz Chaim says two ways to learn the Gemara. Number one, that what the Gemara is saying, that if somebody tells you something, don't say it over, and it's even if it's benign, it's not a halacha, in the sense you're not allowed to say it over. But the Gemara is saying, it's teaching us proper conduct. It's a good habit that if somebody tells you something, don't say it over. It's a good habit. Although it's benign, and although he told it to you, I mean, he divulged it to you, he's not keeping it a secret from you, and there's nothing wrong about it, maybe you can go and say it over. The answer is, you're right, you could say it over because it's benign. At the same time, though, it's a good habit not to say over what somebody tells you, because other times he will be telling you something in confidentiality that if you would say it over, it would hurt him, and because you've developed this habit of not being confidential what people tell you, you're gonna say something you're not supposed to. And therefore, the Chafetz Chaim says, so perhaps the Gemara again is just, you know, deriving from this pasuk a certain level of derech haaretz, a certain level of proper conduct, you know, that the Chafetz Chaim talks about in general, not to say anything bad about anyone, whether it's lashon hara or not, because, you know, you want to have a habit of not saying negative things. Well, here the point would be that even if the person told you something, he told it to you, he let you know it, it's a good habit. Don't say it over, because it's a good habit to develop, because you can land up saying it when you're not supposed to.
Just thinking, but the next sentence, in fact, says, speak to the children of Israel and say to them.
Right.
So, Lamar says, don't speak. And then the next sentence is, speak. And how do they derive the halacha that don't
speak? The simple explanation of the word Lamar is to speak. They're trying to say, alluded in the word lamar is not to speak. Or, according to the Marsha, lamar means to speak, and the whole purpose of saying to speak when it's not necessary is to bring out the idea only because Hashem said to speak. Okay. Now, so that's one way the Chafetz Chaim wants to learn that Gemara. And another way he says is like this, is that you're right, the Ribbono Shel Olam, nothing hurts the Ribbono Shel Olam. But if you think about it, you could actually take the way the Ribbono Shel Olam is speaking to Moshe now, you could actually take it out from there, you could actually take out a lesson from there, in the sense like this. The Ribbono Shel Olam is speaking to Moshe in private. That we know. Hashem spoke to Moshe, only Moshe heard the voice, no one else heard it. So Hashem is speaking to Moshe in private. And therefore, what the halacha is saying is, if somebody tells you something in private, even if it seems benign, but he's telling it to you in private, you have to have permission to say it over. If he is basically showing you that this is meant to be private, even if it doesn't seem to be a reason for it to be private, but he is saying it over you in a way that it's private, then you can't say it over. Because then, if he's telling it to you in private, he may know why this, what seems benign, he doesn't want to get out. So he confided in you, but he doesn't want anybody else to hear it. So even though he's not telling you not to say it, and if he tells you straight out not to say it, that's a different ballgame. He says, don't say it over. That means it's pretty clear that he doesn't want this spread. And if it spreads, it's going to cause some kind of distress.
Like privacy bothers, keep it private. Or,
right, exactly. Exactly.
You know, something like things that they don't want to bring too much in public, they want
right.
to keep it to themselves.
Right, exactly.
Like quietly.
Right. So in this case, even if, let's say, the person didn't necessarily tell you something. However, what he did was, he basically told you in private. If somebody tells you something in private, even if it seems benign, that you cannot say over. That you can't say over. Okay?
So if there wouldn't be a sentence after that saying that...
So you have to know how to deal with the sentence after. Like, what? Why does it have to keep saying speak, speak? That's a good question. But at this point, the Lamar is teaching us about why could you speak? Because Hashem said to speak. Hashem gave permission to do that. And so what comes out at the end here is that there's two things. There's number one, it's a good practice. If somebody tells you something, don't say it over. Even if he tells you in public. He says that in the open. No, he's not saying it secretly. You know, he's coming over and just saying, telling you something. If already he goes ahead and tells it to you in private, even if it's benign, you don't say it over. Because if he's telling it to you in private, you have to assume he wants it to be private. And all the more so if he tells you, don't say it over. Now, what I did see in a sefer, also in the laws of Lashon Hara, is the following. Okay, so basically if I'm telling you something in confidence, you can't say it over. What if I'm telling you in confidence that I plan on hurting someone?
That's like being negative and gossip.
Right. So let me finish. So what's happening here is like this. So the Torah says, Leisamed al dam re'acha. The Torah says, you're not allowed to stand by the blood of your brother, which means that you have to go ahead. If you know that someone is going to be hurt, you're allowed to go ahead, and you have to tell that the person no. So for instance, if I ask you about someone, the Chofetz Chaim talks about in the laws of Lashon Hara, when it's l'to'elus, for a constructive purpose. That means somebody asks you, somebody wants to take someone in as a partner, and so you ask about him from someone, you know, can you tell me about him? Is he trustworthy? Okay. Now, if you tell him he's not trustworthy, right, so you'll say, well, I don't want to say Lashon Hara. But if you know he's not trustworthy, and you don't tell the other person that, the other person is going to be hurt. And therefore, the halacha then is you're allowed to say it over. Don't stand by the blood of your friend. One second, please. Don't stand by the blood of your friend. You have to protect someone from being damaged. So even though you're saying something negative, if it's to protect the other person, you're allowed to do so. So now, let's say the question is, that's, you know, general Lashon Hara. But let's say now we're talking about a situation, I tell you in confidence. I'm going to get this guy. Right? Tell you in confidence. Certainly doesn't want you telling other people, it's going to spoil his plans.
Like, oh yeah, I know.
He's going to spoil his plans. Right? But, can't stand by your brother's blood. So the halacha is, in that situation, you're allowed to break the confidentiality. You're allowed to go tell the person to protect him. Because if this person is trying to hurt the other person, you have to protect the other person. This becomes much more complicated. Much more complicated when it gets to the point of a person whose profession depends on confidentiality. A lawyer, a therapist, where these people, their profession is confidentiality. And so number one, if they break the confidentiality, they can lose their parnas and they can lose their source of livelihood. And actually, if it gets out that, you know, religious therapists, right, don't keep the confidentiality, then they'll lose their chance of being able to help other people.
Of course.
So therefore, it becomes a much greater question, a much bigger problem when these kind of people face that problem. If a therapist hears from his patient that he plans on hurting someone, right, it's supposed to be confidential. Halakhically, what do you do? It's a big question. If a person finds in that situation, they have to ask a shayla. But the point is that we have this obligation to, if somebody tells us something in confidence, we have to keep that confidence. We have to be trustworthy and not reveal it. If the confidence is regarding something that could damage someone else, then you're allowed to say it over. If you're a therapist or a lawyer and it's your parnasa, and it's your livelihood, and it can create much other big problems, it becomes much complicated, and that you need to ask about it.
Excuse me.